Welcome to the third episode of the Fisheries Podcast. In this episode, I continue my conversation with Dr. Quinn Phelps about invasive carp, and we determine who the real expert is. Thank you for joining me. I am Nick Kramer, and this is the Fisheries Podcast, a podcast aimed at sharing the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, you can follow the podcast on Twitter at Fisheries Pod, as well as on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast. In this episode, I continue a conversation I had with Dr. Quinton Phelps, as well as my brother, on invasive carps, why they're so invasive, why they're so hard to get rid of, and why won't people eat them. Towards the end, we play a fun game to determine who the real expert is, Quinton or my brother. If you haven't listened to the second episode yet, I suggest you go back and do that. I provide an introduction for Quinton. He describes what he's currently working on, and we discuss some fisheries management terms such as the dynamic rate functions of recruitment, growth, and mortality. Our conversation then shifted from fisheries management to invasive carps with the following question. So one of the toughest hurdles to some in fisheries management is dealing with invasive species and the interactions of those with our native fishes. Your master's work dealt with common carp, and your advisor for several students studying silver and bighead carp on the Mississippi River. You were there in Missouri when they first naturally reproduced black carp were found. If you could describe each of these species to someone who has no idea what they look like.
Right. Okay. So silver carp, start with the one that probably everyone is the most familiar with. Long torpedo, relatively torpedo-shaped fish, very much fusiform, which is torpedo-shaped. These fish are probably the most problematic of the invasive species, of the invasive Asian carp species, at least as of this date. They're the most abundant. They're the ones that you've seen on CNN or on CBS jumping out of the water, jumping into folks' boats, jumping while someone's doing some water skiing on one of the big rivers. Big head carp, they look relatively similar to a silver carp. I guess let me step back. So the silver carp, they can get, you know, upwards of, 30, 40, maybe even bigger in terms of the poundage. And then you can have big head carp. They look very similar in appearance to the silver carp, except they have a blotchy pattern to them, mixed in with that silver color like the silvers. But these fish tend to get a lot bigger, upwards of, 80, 90, 100 pounds. Big heads don't jump like the silver carp do, even though we have seen some big heads jump in the past. Both big heads and silver carp consume our plankton species, so that's zooplankton and phytoplankton, and that's the very base end of the food web. And really, that's the big problem with both of those species, is that given their abundance, they're eating the base end of the food web, which all of our native species depends on. Okay, so let's move on to the other two that are, more similar in appearance. That's the grass carp and the black carp. These are, again, a torpedo-shaped species, but different in terms of their looks or their appearance relative to big heads and silvers, in that both of these species have much larger scales, and they're probably even more torpedo-shaped than the big heads and the silvers. Grass carp, as their name suggests, they're going to be eating some sort of vegetation. That's not available. They'll switch over to maybe consuming all of the decaying plants that are on the bottom of the system. So that's called detritus. Or they can even consume invertebrates if that detritus, or even if those invertebrates are mixed in with that detritus. Black carp, as you alluded to, they're the newest member on the scene. Black carp are a molluscivore, and this one has probably one of the biggest they have the most ability to be injurious to our aquatic systems because they consume mussels. Our mussel populations in North America in our big rivers are very much in trouble. And we're now seeing that black carp have invaded both the Mississippi and Ohio River basins, where we have a ton of federally endangered and state threatened mussel species. So it's imperative that we really think about, you know, what black carp are doing and how injurious they could be if they became super abundant in our aquatic systems. So common carp, that's the last of the common, last of the carp species, and they are the oldest. They're the oldest of the carp species, at least how in terms of being in America. That you know, the late 1870s through early 1900s, they were introduced to North America as a food fish, and really since their introduction, their range is basically all over the United States. So these fish are in lakes, rivers, streams, reservoirs. They're pretty much everywhere. When a fish management biologist collects one of these, even though it's not a native species, we pretty much think of them and not really in the invasive white like we would think of maybe a black carp or grass carp or a big head or a silver, just because, you know, they've been around for so long.
What is it about each of these species that makes them such good invaders?
So, and I don't care which one of them that we're going to talk about, be any of the carp species. So one is that they have high fecundity. All of them have high fecundity, which means that they're producing a lot of eggs. They can have a lot of hatchlings. So that means that there's going to be a lot of little ones that are produced by every fish that's out there. They have a broad range of environmental tolerance. So that means that they can handle super cold water. That means they can handle super warm water. They thrive in all those environments. They can be in rivers. They can be in reservoirs. They can be in streams. They are very much opportunistic when it comes to feeding. They're all pretty much very efficient predators. So even though they're really not a predator, like they're consuming other fish, whatever it is that they consume, they're very efficient at consuming it. They can move very long distances in super short amount of time. We had one silver carp female that we tagged with a transmitter that moved about 400 miles in a matter of 7 days. And that was in the Mississippi River. So these things have the capacity to move and invade new locations in a very short time period. So when we take all of those sort of attributes that I just talked about and we put them into a nice little package together, that's what makes them a great invader.
Another question from the audience. This one's coming from Donald Orth on Twitter. How will large rivers with abundant naturalized Asian carps compare with present conditions?
I think what's really cool about Dr. Orth's question there is that I was really fortunate, as you well know, Nick, when we were in Missouri, I was able to use something called the long-term resource monitoring element data. So this is a project that has been conducting standardized fishery sampling since 1993, actually a little bit before that, but standardized in the fashion that I'm talking about since 1993 at six different locations throughout the Mississippi River Basin. So they are taking a lot of data from all species that are out there using a whole host of different gears to catch basically a representative sample of all the fishes that are there. So what we were able to do is that we were able to use the LTRM data to then be able to look at what the effects of a silver and big head carp were on the Mississippi River ecosystem. Now, why were we able to do that? Carp really didn't become fully established in the Mississippi River until somewhere between 2001, 2003. And so we had a lot of data prior to that, say from 1993 to 2001. And then we had, after they had become established, we had all this fishery data from 2001 to 2017, that we could look at to be able to look to see what the fish community looked like before relative to after. Basically, what we were able to find with that information is that one of the very important prey species that we have out there for a lot of our obligate predators, thing like a walleye or a largemouth bass or a blue catfish, flathead catfish, that would be consuming these prey species like gizzard shad, since the Asian carp became established, the relative number of fish or the relative number of gizzard shad that were out there had declined. There's also another large river obligate planktivore called the bigmouth buffalo that also experienced the same declines once the silver carp and big head become established in the river. So what we're seeing, Nick, at least on the grand scale, is that silver carp do have the ability to alter the fish community. Now, the one thing I'll add to that is that, you know, that's only two species, so it doesn't seem like a lot. But the other thing that we were able to do is that during 2011, there was a substantial flood in the Mississippi River Basin, and we were able to look at some lakes that became inundated after a flood. In one of these lakes, these had never been inundated before, so there were no silver carp or big head in any of these systems before this flood happened. We had one of the lakes that didn't have any carp in it, and then we had one of these floodplain lakes that had tons and tons of carp that inundated it or invaded it. And what we started doing is that right after the river receded, we went back out to all these depressions or existing lakes that were on the landscape, and we started sampling them. And what we saw in the lake that didn't have any carp invade it during the flood, we didn't see any changes in the fish community. And then in the lake that had the most Asian carp present, I think there were six or seven species present in that lake. And over the course of a six-month evaluation that we were doing using electrofishing, the only species that was left after that time period was silver carp. So they do have the ability to exclude native species within water bodies, especially if they're in very high abundance. But it also suggests it's not necessarily a death knell for native species as long as the abundance remains relatively low. So that's what we were able to see from these four floodplain lakes that had varying densities of carp in them. There's a really cool paper that we published in 2017 with a bunch of my good collaborators in a journal called PLOS One.
So then once these carp get established, why are they so hard to get rid of?
The first is that they're elusive. They are good at getting around nets. They are good at evading the electrofishing boat. Those two reasons are probably the biggest as to why we can't get rid of them. Remember, like I was saying earlier, these fish have the ability to move, and they can move long distances over a short amount of time. So if you have a big river like the Mississippi or the Ohio that has thousands of river miles within its basin, the reason that they're so hard to get rid of there is because they could simply be anywhere. You think about how rivers work and how they're sort of, you could use the analogy to highways. The river is just a series of highways. There are highways that build off of interstates. There's country roads that build off of those basic state highways. And then there's even smaller roads that go off of those county roads. That's the same way that rivers work, and that those fish can navigate all of those various tributaries, I guess you could call them, off of the main stem.
So because of that complexity of the whole river system, some people are kind of leery that we'll ever be able to remove or even knock back invasive carps, especially in a complex system such as the Mississippi River drainage.
So, Nick, that's a really good question. And I think my suggestion to that is, one, humans are very good at exploiting resources. We can take a look at something that had a really high reproductive capacity, like passenger pigeons. Most people probably don't even know what a passenger pigeon is. They have been extirpated or they're extinct now. You know, I think about buffalo, I think about prairie chickens. I think about, you know, all of these critters on our landscape that have been either harvested or habitat has been fragmented so much where the populations have been reduced. Your question was, could we do anything about this? I think another big point to make here is that there is no way that we're ever going to make a dent in the Asian carp population unless we as managers and all of the public get together and really think about how we could get rid of them. And it can't just be scientists working on this. There has to be backing by the public. And that was one of the big things that I've been working on, is trying to figure out how we can get this wonderful protein source on people's plates. That's just one way to remove them is harvest. There's something called integrated pest management. And again, relating back to that PLOS One paper, it talks briefly about how we could use the IPM or integrated pest management very much like the folks in agriculture do to remove pests from corn, soybeans, wheat, etc., to make sure that we're getting the highest yield in those areas. It's a combination of biological, chemical, mechanical removal approaches to counteract or to reduce the population of whatever pest it is that we're dealing with. I will say this, and I'll stand on this until the day I'm dead, is that there's not one specific silver bullet to get rid of the Asian carp. There's not. And is it going to be difficult? It is going to be difficult. But I think if we can band together as conservationists, I think that we can make a big dent in the population.
So a lot of studies, like you said, have shown that the easiest way to get rid of, the only way to get rid of them, is to increase harvest. And that might be a difficult task. Like you said, we killed off the passenger pigeon. We've greatly reduced our bison herds. People aren't going to harvest them unless there's a market for them. Do you ever think that we'll get to a point where a market will develop and we'll actually be able to knock these back?
That's a really good question, Nick. And I think that relays back to one thing. All of my colleagues and I, and including you, have really pushed this peanut forward. But there are a lot of negative perceptions associated with people consuming carp. I was actually having a discussion with one of the administrators at WVU tonight and talking to him about it. And as soon as I said the word carp, he said, "Oh yes, carp. Those are not a good fish to eat." And I asked him, I said, "Well, have you ever consumed one?" And he said, "No." Well, someone told me that. That's the perception that we're dealing with, is that carp are this fish that are not good to eat. And that's the very reason that markets are not being developed. Here's a little a shout out to the commercial guys. The commercial guys are not making enough money. They're getting somewhere between 15 and 20 cents a pound to go out and collect these fish. One of my good buddies is a commercial guy down in Kentucky, and he would be willing to fish these fish, but he simply is not making enough money off of the fish at 15 or 20 cents a pound in order to repair his nets. I mean, you think about all of that damage that the carp are doing to the nets. Think about all of the boat gas that it takes, and then the fuel for his truck. By the time that you pay for all of your expenses and you sell your fish, you're not going to come out on top. You can't make a livelihood out of them yet because the price is not there. So everybody's solution seems to be, well, let's make cat food or dog food out of them. And in my opinion, that's not really the solution either, because cat food and dog food is something that's very inexpensive. This needs to be something that is put on a dinner plate for your family to consume in the evenings. And let me talk quickly about how delicious they are. We did several blind taste tests where we had tilapia, catfish, and carp all on the same plate. And silver carp, as long as our constituents, the people that were doing the taste test, didn't know what they were consuming, there was nearly a 2-to-1 preference for consuming silver carp over tilapia or catfish. So the reason, Nick, that these markets are not established is one, that we believe that we are too good to consume carp. And the second is that until we can get over that, there's not going to be a big enough market that is going to allow the commercial fishers to make enough money to make it happen. Hopefully what I'm saying there is we need to band together. We need to drop our preconceived notions that we have about carp. We need to move away from that. And we need to think about this in terms, we need to think bigger in terms of, hey, just because it says carp, I need to give it a chance first to see if I like it. And then secondly, we need to throw away those preconceived notions that we have. That's it. If we could do that, and then we could convince our commercial guys to get out there and start tackling them, along with some other things within that integrated pest management framework, I think we could not only develop markets, but we could start to make a dent in the population.
Jacob, have you ever eaten carp?
No, I haven't.
Just, you've never been offered?
No, but I kind of want some now.
Go down to the Missouri River, you can snag some.
Yeah. Are carp considered invasive wherever they are found?
Yeah.
Or is it based solely on their ability to reproduce and change the system? Or they have to be native somewhere.
So they're native to China. And then the Yangtze River, which I do a lot of work with the Chinese scientists. And basically what they've seen over there is that their carp population is at a very, very low abundance relative to ours. So what we're trying to do is maybe learn from them on sort of what has happened to their ecosystems and how have they harvested that resource? What specific harvest strategies do they have that we could incorporate here to maybe knock down the population? And as it relates to your invasive question, yes, they're invasive anywhere that you would catch them, at least in North America.
So can a native fish also be invasive?
I'm sure it could be at least invasive in nature, but I don't know any specific examples of that. And I'm sure that someone will listen, that listens to the podcast will be able to provide some insight to that. And maybe I'm just not thinking of something right now. I think a lot of times maybe the word invasive isn't right, but maybe nuisance could happen. And we see that in bluegill populations, bass populations, and small impoundments a lot, where maybe you have a very high abundance of very small bluegills, can't catch any or couldn't catch any of the bigger size bluegills. And in that case, I think they would be considered a nuisance more than invasive.
I guess if you're considering natives on like a countrywide scale, we've moved walleye and smallmouth bass to trout streams in the mountains where they've outcompeted a native trout out there to the point where they're considered invasive or nuisance species and they're trying to get rid of them. But as far as like native within their own range, native range become invasive, I think Quentin nailed it with bluegill or crappie becoming stunted.
Yeah, right, right. That's a good point.
Or like how in some rivers known for trout fishing, they tell you to, you catch a certain species of trout to keep it out because someone introduced it there at one point and it's taking over the stream.
Right. So that could be brown trout or rainbow trout in a native brook trout stream. And we do see some of that, but that's again more related to someone introducing those fish in those areas. So yeah, I think between what, you know, what Nick suggested about, you know, walleyes and these, you know, salmonid streams, native salmonid streams, or the brook trout, rainbow trout, brown trout streams. I think that's another good example. But again, those are introduced into those locations and they could be considered invasive.
Well, I think we've had enough of the hard questions. So now we're going to do a little quiz to see who the real expert about carp is. So I'm going to ask Quentin a question about different carp characteristics, such as how old they get. And then Jacob, you'll answer whether you think the answer is going to be higher or lower. So it's kind of like card sharks back in the day. I didn't have time to scour the entire internet. So all these numbers were taken from fishbase.org for these species. All right, so Quentin, what is the maximum age of common carp?
40 years.
Jacob, higher or lower?
No, higher.
Ooh, it's 38, so Quentin gets the point on that one. How many states are common carp found in?
48.
Jacob, higher or lower?
Lower.
They're found in 49, so Quentin gets another point there. How long can grass carp get their maximum length?
I should know this. I'm going to say 1,250 millimeters.
Let me convert that to inches.
50 inches.
Jacob, do they get bigger or smaller than 50 inches?
Smaller.
Quinn gets the point again there. They can reach up to 1,500 millimeters or 59 inches.
Oh, wow.
So a common distinguishing feature for fish is their fin ray count. About how many dorsal fin rays do grass carp have?
Oh man, that's a good one. I'm gonna say 10.
You got it right on the head. I have about 10 written down.
Yeah, I was gonna say 10 too.
So what is the length at which silver carp become mature?
So I think that's variable, Nick. So but I would say, I'm going to say somewhere between 300 and 400 millimeters. So somewhere between 12 and 16 inches. You need one answer for me. So I'm going to say 14 inches or 350 millimeters.
Jacob?
I'll say higher.
Fishbase has 51.7 centimeters or 20.4 inches. So Jacob gets the point there.
All right. Well, might have to talk to those people.
At what temperature do silver carp begin to spawn?
21 degrees Celsius.
Jacob? I'll go higher.
Well, they have a range of 18 to 26, so we'll just say that's a wash.
All right. Right
on. All right. And then how many eggs can a gravid big head carp produce?
I'm going to say 1 million.
All right. Jacob, higher or lower?
Is this over a lifespan or at a single time?
At a single time.
Lower.
Well, if Fishbase is correct, Quinn might have to talk to him. They only had 100,000 written down.
Okay. Well, and maybe my math calculation in my brain is wrong. So, either way.
I didn't check out all the citations for these numbers. I just took the numbers. How many days do big head eggs drift before hatching?
Oh, I should know this one. I'm going to say 3 days.
All right. Jacob, higher or lower?
Lower.
It is 2 days. Jacob gets the point.
Oh, dang it.
We have two questions left, and right now is Quentin 4, Jacob 3.
Oh, goodness.
At what age do black carp become sexually mature?
I'm going to say age 3.
All right. Jacob, higher or lower?
Lower.
It is 4 to 6.
Yeah.
That puts it out of reach.
Jacob, if you could nail this one right on the head, we'll give you a chance to guess the exact number. After Quentin, of course. We'll let him give you a hint. According to the USGS Non-Indigenous Aquatic Species Database, how many hydrologic unit codes or watersheds has black carp been found in?
Oh, this is a big number. Wow. Hundred.
Jacob?
100 was his answer?
Yep.
100 was my answer.
Can you elaborate more on what you mean? Watersheds where they're found?
So I guess specific river drainages. So like within your Mississippi River drainage, you have the Missouri River. Within that, you would have like the Nishnabotna, then Keg Creek and Mosquito Creek. So Keg Creek would be its own hydrologic unit code or watershed.
Okay. I'll say 129.
We're probably both way off.
The website has 25. I don't know how current that is, but that's what they had on the web.
It's that number, Nick. I whether or not that's right or not, black carp are the new game on the street, and they're quickly moving up the Ohio River and the Mississippi, reproducing in the Mississippi, at least in the Mississippi Basin. And man, that's another one that we're going to have to be dealing with. Coming up in a very short time period.
Well, would a new species of carp, like you were just talking about, push out a previously invasive species?
Yeah, so that's a good question, too. The cool but very unfortunate part about carp is that each one of these carp evolved together, so they're all consuming something much different in the aquatic ecosystem. So common carp are invertivore, insectivore, black are molluscivore, predominant molluscivore, grass carp are consuming vegetation, big heads are consuming mostly zooplankton, and then silver carp are consuming phytoplankton and zooplankton. They're all really fulfilling a different niche. I personally don't believe that one is going to exclude the other, even though there could be competition between silver carp and big heads.
Quentin is going to keep his expert title for carp. His championship belt is in the mail. All of that information was gathered from fishbase.org. That's a large free source of information for an abundance of fish. And they recently had some funding sources back out and are in need of help. So if you use this website or have used it in the past, please consider donating to them so we can continue to do fun little quizzes like this on future episodes. Quentin, we only have 5 more questions, and then I'll let you get back to your important business. And this is a group of 5 questions that I plan to ask each one of our expert guests. And we'll start real simple. Just what is your favorite fish?
Oh, bluegills are probably my favorite fish. My mom and my dad, when I graduated as from South Dakota State University, what they gave me for my graduation present was a blown-up picture of the first bluegill that I ever caught on the Pittsburgh State University campus in Pittsburgh, Kansas.
That sounds really cool.
Yeah, man, it is cool.
What is your favorite memory from your career thus far?
My favorite memory is seeing all of my graduate students go on and do good things. That's it.
Perhaps you're already in it, but what is your dream job or dream location to work in?
I think I am my dream job, man. I've got exactly what I want. I'm doing research and I'm teaching, and I'm able to go out and do outreach or service to the public. Now I'm in my dream job. The dream location is wherever I am.
So if money was not an issue, what is one project that you would love to work on?
Oh, that's a cool one. I would really like to develop the same program that we had on the Mississippi River with the LTRM. That project is so informative. If I could help initiate this on all of the big rivers in North America and maybe even beyond, that's what I would do is to get that program started, some sort of standardized sampling on the Missouri River,
on the Ohio River, on the Wabash, on the Potomac, all over the country. Wherever I could go to initiate that, I think I would do that, because the reason that I say that, and even we could go even broader, maybe even into China on the Yangtze or on the Yellow, and to other countries, the Nile and the Amazon, and you know, all of those big rivers need to have evaluations, because in the future, given how our population is going, we're going to need to be able to evaluate the effects and try to figure out how we can counteract the negative effects that we're causing on these aquatic systems. So, but first step would be getting the LTRM going on the Ohio River. And if there's anybody out there that wants to do that, give me a call. I'm ready.
And if there is one point or principle that you could have programmed into everybody's head, what would it be?
Well, I have to give you two. One is that we as scientists should never feel like that we're better than anyone else. And sometimes a scientist can come across that they're better than others, whether that's other scientists or when we're talking to the public. We should try to never do that. And then I think the other thing, and this was from my major advisor, is that not everything is black and white. And so what that means is that what we do as fisheries managers, even though we have good scientific information, we have to be really mindful and be able to be behind these data. Because for as much as we want everything to be scientific, there's a bit of art that goes into conducting science. And we have to be smarter than our data.
And I lied, there's actually a sixth question, but perhaps the most important one I'm going to ask. Who was your favorite graduate student?
Oh, man, I'm not doing that one. No. No, all of them are my favorite. So, my favorite graduate student was all my graduate students. So, no, that was a good try, but no, I can't do that one.
You can't hurt me.
You're my favorite today, all right? You did this. Good for you.
Well, that's all I have for you. So, thank you for coming on the show today and answering some questions. I'm sure the listeners will appreciate your input. And I'm sure I'll be asking you to come back on the show sometime again in the future. And you don't use social media, so if anybody wants to get a hold of you and ask questions, what would be the best way to do that?
So easiest way is to send me an email, quinton.phelps@mail.wvu.edu. And, of course, anything on Google, if you type my name in, you'd be able to find something. I'm pretty for sure about it. So I think that's probably the best way. And then I also have to say, go Mountaineers, right? Go WVU.
Unless they're playing the Cyclones.
Yeah, well, we'll have to talk about that, I guess.
And if you'd like to get a hold of me, you can find me on Twitter at Fisheries Pod or on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast or old-fashioned email feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope that you enjoyed this episode of the Fisheries Podcast. If you did, make sure to rate us wherever you downloaded the podcast. And if you have any questions, comments, concerns, or other feedback, make sure you reach out to me on any of those platforms mentioned earlier. As Quinton said, make sure you remember scientists are not better than others or the public, and not everything is black and white. Be smarter than your data. And get out there and go eat some carp. I am Nick Kramer. And thank you for listening to the third episode of the Fisheries Podcast.